Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, you are listening to New Books in American South, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jackson Reinhardt, and today I am with Regina L. Wagner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at University of Alabama, to talk about her new book, Electoral Patterns in Alabama, Local Change and Continuity Amid National Trends, published by Palgrave Macmillan 2022 in the Palgrave Studies in U.S. Election series. While significant attention in political science is devoted to national-level elections, an in-depth look at state-level political dynamics in the United States is so far sorely missing, and state-level electoral developments and shifts are often treated as mere reflections of national-level dynamics and patterns, which significantly impacts our ability to understand macro-level electoral shifts in the United States in general. This book analyzes gubernatorial, congressional, and presidential election results in the state of Alabama from 1945 through 2020. Comprehensive maps of county-level partisan shifts make it possible to isolate pivotal elections and compare state-level and national trends over time, and extensive electoral data on county-level allows placing state-level electoral behavior in its regional and national context. Detailed county-level demographic and economic data is used to provide local context for electoral patterns, shifts, and continuities. Well, Regina, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, before we get into the content of the book, tell me a little bit about your academic background and the impetus for writing Electoral Patterns in Alabama.
Sure. I'm currently at the University of Alabama. I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin in 2018 in political science. And that was actually, my dissertation was looking at women's political representation in the U.S. And then I started working at UA, where I still am as an assistant professor in 2018. And really part of so this book came out of a larger project that I had, started working on that looked at, gubernatorial elections across the country and sort of shifts that were happening on the county level. And I still hope to work on that. But that is a lot of data. So my idea was starting in 1912, going up to about 2020 and just look at all gubernatorial elections to see if there are sort of regional patterns that we can discern. And I sort of, you know, because I am in the state and I was interested in what is going on here. And, you know, there also with some of the recent elections, there's been some more national interest in Alabama. I decided, you know, I could pull that out of the project and sort of focus on that state first. And see where that goes, and then sort of return to the bigger project. So that's kind of where this came from.
Sure. So in your research in this book, and also as you indicate in your research on gubernatorial elections, you have an interest in county level results and county level shifts. What's the benefit of utilizing counties and analyzing, in this case, Alabama's shifting political and partisan affiliation?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I wanted to sort of go at as sort of granular level as was possible. And now ideally you would want precinct level data, but that is just not available for sort of, you know, elections going back more than a couple of years. So if you want to go back, and ideally I still want to go back, you know, past 1945 into, you know, earlier decades. So really The data availability, the smallest sort of unit you can find for those earlier decades is just the county. And sort of my idea was if we can, you know, a lot of times we just look at the state as a unit, but there really is a lot going on inside of these states, you know, and we can see that in this book too, I think, that the regions are just doing very different things, right? And so in a perfect world, I would be able to tell you what the precincts are doing, but, you know, that is just not available, unfortunately, for that time frame. So I think the county is kind of, you know, the best we can get to see sort of shifts below, you know, the state level. And so, you know, and we can get into this, you know, when we start talking about the book, but sort of there is, you know, it looks like the state is doing something, like the entire state is doing the same thing, right? But once you start looking at not just the county level, but the shifts, you start seeing that only parts of it are doing that, right? And some other parts are actually doing something else, which I think is, you know, both fascinating and, you know, something that we can maybe use today to think about elections, but also that gets lost if we just look at, oh, you know, at the state level, this is what the South was doing, or this is what, you know, what this or that state was doing. So,
yeah, you've mentioned parts and regions in your previous answer, and a focus of your argument is that even amidst a one-party Democratic state, that there was serious political division in Alabama. Can you elaborate on this, you know, century-long factionalism, which you classify as regional economic over racial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that actually, you know, the extent of that really kind of surprised me when I started looking at the maps, right? Because again, if you just compare one election to the next, you know, you see this sort of deeply blue or deeply Democratic state, you know, going on for decades. But if you start looking at the shifts, you see that that's not the case, right? And so then, what I started finding is sort of that the northern part of the state, and again, like you said, this was an economic division, right? So there was a lot of agreement on racial issues. There really wasn't any division, and the electorate was all white, right? They had successfully disenfranchised Black voters. So really, you didn't, not that race wasn't important, it obviously was really important, but it wasn't a dividing issue, right? So it didn't sort of structure the political conflicts within the state, because everyone who was able to vote agreed, right? And people who didn't agree, you know, were excluded from voting. So you had these divisions that were, you know, centered around economics, and they really go back a long time. And I kind of talk about this a little bit in the book where, you know, even they go back to how the state was settled, right? And where these settlers came from. And also they go back to sort of the geographic differences in the state. You really can't have, you know, large plantations in northern Alabama, right? You don't have sort of the soil for it. You don't have the, and so you really didn't see that, right? And that was influencing the politics of the region, right? And you can see that throughout, you know, you mentioned that you lived in Tennessee, right? You can see that through, you know, parts of Appalachia in other areas, right? So Appalachians were, you know, different from other Southerners in political respects, and it was largely economic, right? And you can kind of see that in Alabama too. So you have sort of a more populist, maybe economically progressive region in the north, and you have sort of the big plantation owners, sort of what we think of if we, you know, when we think of the southern, you know, economy going on in the southern part of the state, right? And this is where, you know, this is actually the part of the state that has the highest, you know, Black population, because this is where the slave owning plantations were, right? And so you have this really strong division. And honestly, as I said, when I was starting to work on this, I was surprised by how big of a political division that was causing, right? And again, that was purely over sort of resources and you know, attempts by the southern part of the state to exclude these sort of poor farmers in the northern parts from, you know, just kind of disenfranchise them too in a way, right? And they were kind of getting caught up in some of this legislation. But that wasn't a new thing, right? That was, and I kind of try to show that these factions were just building on each other, but they were always, you know, formed by the same divisions, if that makes sense.
No, it completely does. Another part of your argument is that the realignment away from the Democratic Party first began with presidential elections, then it took decades for gubernatorial and senatorial. Why was it presidential elections that was the first result in Alabama realigning. And in fact, in the election you speak about where that realignment happens, they didn't necessarily go to Republicans.
Right. And they actually didn't want to go to Republicans at first, right? Because the Republican Party was sort of, that was the party you didn't support, right? That was the party that you, a Southerner couldn't be a Republican, right? That was sort of still ingrained. So at first, when they were trying to look for some way, I think in, you know, in 1948, it was basically just a way to register your discontent, right? And I think I say this too in the book where, the idea was, well, if we show them that they can't win without us, then they will have to change course, right? And that, you know, didn't work out. And Truman did win without them. So, you know, so much for that plan, right? But the idea was we can get the Democratic Party to change. So as for your question, why the presidential level? I think one big part was that Democrats started changing the way that you were, got the nomination, right? So up until 1936, you needed a two-thirds majority of delegates to be the Democratic nominee. And that was because they had to find someone who was acceptable to the entire, you know, kind of unwieldy coalition that they had. And they changed that to a simple majority, which essentially took away the South's power to veto presidential nominees, right? So suddenly you could become the Democratic nominee and not be liked by the South, right? Which was not possible before. And that, in a way, I think that's what started it, because you could say, you know, for Alabama specifically, again, Alabama Democrats really didn't have a lot of control over who the presidential nominee was anymore. So that is where you see the rift, right? This is where you see the party moving in a direction, in that case, especially on race, right? That the Alabama Democratic Party didn't like and that their voters didn't like. The senators and especially the governors were able to distance themselves from that, right? So if you think about George Wallace, he was very different from the National Democratic Party at the time that he was governor, right? So you still... that's one side of why it took longer for those offices to shift. I think the other sort of part of the coin here is that Republicans also implemented a top-down strategy when they tried to, you know, implement their Southern strategy. It was something that was sort of trickling down, right? So you had both of those things working together, sort of flipping the presidential level first, and, you know, taking much, much longer to, you know, I mean, in the 90s, right, when the House flipped, that was kind of still a surprise. So, you know, it took much longer. But people in the South were voting for president, for Republicans for president, much earlier than that. So you just sort of have a greater control, I think, over your nominees for these other offices.
Sure. How did factional control of the Democratic Party in Alabama, the progressives in the 40s and 50s, mid-60s, and then the Dixiecrat conservatives in the 60s and 70s, influence regional support for the party? Because it seems that some regions, depending on who controlled the party, were more supportive than others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that also I thought was really interesting when I sort of started looking into those patterns, right? So as I said earlier, your northern part of the state really was fairly, you know, rebellious, if you want to call it that. They were the ones who were sort of most likely to find some way to register their, you know, disapproval. Either that might be by actually voting for Republicans. You had some Republicans, you know, on the local level that would win, or at least voting for some sort of third party candidate, you know. So you still had Democrats winning, obviously, but on the local level, it was sort of more of a mixed bag. But then, as you said, in the 50s and 60s, the faction that they liked the best started taking control of some offices, right? So you had Jim Folsom becoming governor. You had two senators who were, you know, aligned with this economically progressive faction. And that meant that the northern part of the state stopped. They actually became a little bit more democratic, right? So when the state as a whole started shifting away from the party, at least, you know, to some extent, this sort of most rebellious part of the state moved in the opposite direction, because they were like, hey, like, these are the people we like, right? These are the Democrats that we like the most. And you can see that reverse, right? As soon as you have, you know, the Sparkman and Hill retire, for example, you have George Wallace in the governor's office. The the northern part of the state really doesn't have, you basically have conservatives in both parties now in Alabama on economic issues, right? So you really don't, there's no reason for, the Hill Country to move towards Democrats now, because that's, and so then you can have, now that there is a racial division between the parties, right? But there isn't really, within Alabama, there isn't really an economically progressive, the senators or the candidates you have now are just conservative, a part of the conservative party. So there's really no reason to stay with this national party that's become more racially liberal, right? And so, that, if that makes sense, that's kind of how these regions shift around depending on factions. So it's really kind of fascinating to see, when the state as a whole becomes more Republican, it's actually the most Republican region that becomes a little bit more Democratic, right? And that's because of the progressives that have, these are the kinds of appeals that this part of the state has been receptive to.
Yeah, there was a great statistic you mentioned. I think, people who follow politics now or even of the past 20 years would be surprised by this. But in the late 60s, the Democratic Party in Alabama was more conservative than your average Republican Alabaman. So but over time, within 20 years, and we'll get to that, that changed. So by the 60s, the state is treading away from the Democratic Party on a national level. And it seems because there's a Dixiecrat in control of the Democratic Party in Alabama, they're not moving away to the Democratic Party just yet. But the elections are nonetheless getting closer in the senatorial and gubernatorial level. But then how does the mass enfranchisement of Black Alabamans affect not only Democratic electoral results, but the way in which Democratic candidates campaign in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, and that is also, I think, really fascinating. So once you have, Black Alabamians entering the electorate, right, you sort of remove these really extensive barriers that they had to participation. They start participating, and they start being sort of, at first, they don't really like the Alabama Democratic Party because of what it is, right, but they do like the National Democratic Party. And so Democrats start sort of, and you see this even with George Wallace in his very, very last election, right? Everyone knows George Wallace, but he sort of ran, extremely sort of race baiting and segregationist campaigns. In his very last election, he tries to appeal to Black voters because he knows, they're a big part of the coalition now, and even I have to sort of appeal to them, right? And so he sort of, he does this visit to a Black church, and he sort of is trying to, even he is sort of trying to change the way that he campaigns, because these openly sort of, racist appeals that he was running on before won't work anymore, right? Because a lot of the people who would have voted for him, based on that, have become Republicans. And a lot of the people that are Democrats now are, African-American, are Black voters, right? And so it really changes. And even the progressive, if you think back to Sparkman and Hill, even the progressive senators, Sparkman was pretty much openly, conservative on racial issues. And Hill, tried to stay away from them, or at least do it sort of out of the spotlight, right? So they didn't, because that's, that wasn't a winning issue, right? So you didn't, and Governor Folsom back in the 50s, he actually didn't run away from the issue, and it was really sort of, detrimental for him electorally. So this, even this progressive faction in earlier decades knew, even if I don't want to run on race baiting, I shouldn't run on, civil rights and sort of racially liberal, messages, because there's really, at this point, no audience that's going to vote for me based on that. But that has changed, right? So once you're in the 70s and the 80s, you're in a different world, right? You have a lot of your voters now are Black voters, right? And so you really need to, change your tune to still win, right? And for a while, I think, sort of gerrymandering and some of those things have changed that. But for a while, there was this attempt to say, well, maybe we can, kind of bridge the gap and have this, you know, and you still had some white Democrats winning in, you know, in Alabama and southern states, which really you don't find as much anymore today, right? Because, you know, the only places you win are majority black districts. And so they tend to, you know, why would they elect, you know, white representatives, right? But at this time, the idea was, well, maybe I can build this coalition of both black and white voters, or not, you know, and they can maybe, you know, I can be a moderate that's sort of bridging the gap. And that, you know, that worked for some of them for some time.
But you still see that in places like Alabama and North Carolina, where you have large black populations, but also a white electorate that will still vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you still see it in some parts, but it has, it's sort of a smaller, there's a smaller group than what they envisioned at the time, right? So during these breakups, there was sort of a bigger, you know, if you look at Congress, right, if you look at the Senate, that used to be a bigger group, a bigger block in Congress, right, than it is today. So I don't know if that answered your question, but
it definitely has. Thank you. And related to this, you indicate that while Alabama is under like a new one party control, one that you write is even more polarized than it really ever has been, there still exists regional divisions in voting that mirrors the mid-century divisions, which you mm-hmm. speak about, which you write about, but there's a key difference. What's the difference between the regional differences now than what they were, say, in the 1950s?
Well, so you basically still have the Black Belt. So there's still a strong difference between the southern part of the state, right, especially the Black Belt, and that northern part of the Hill Country. They still vote for opposite, and the Black Belt still votes Democratic, and the Hill Country still votes Republican, right? But or you know, they didn't vote Republican back then, but more Republican. But now you sort of have. You've reversed the rebelliousness, if you want to call it that, right? So the Hill Country, which always was kind of rebelling against the dominant party, is now sort of really loyal to the dominant party, which has become the Republican Party, right? And the Black Belt is now sort of the rebellious region. That is because of it is also the region with the highest percentage of Black voters who are now part of the electorate, right? And so who is voting in the Black Belt has changed, and who is voting for Democrats in the Black Belt has changed, right? And so you have a lot of counties in that area that are majority Black. And so that used to not matter for elections, you know, back in the 50s, because they were disenfranchised, right? But now it matters. So you basically have this division now that is a lot more based or you know, that is a lot more sort of centered around race rather than economic issues, right? Because back then, so first of all, the rebelliousness has flipped, but also the issue that's dividing or you know, making you vote for one party or the other has shifted from economics to race, right? Because race has become, you know, throughout the civil rights movement and everything that came along with it, it has become so much more salient. And it has polarized the electorate, right? It has, you know, it has made Southern Black voters very loyal Democrats. And at the same time, right, white voters in the South have moved away from the Democratic Party. Now, obviously not all of them, but, you know, a large percentage of them. So that's kind of how you still, interestingly, you know, that was also sort of fascinating to me that it's the same. The regions are still divided the same way, right? It's just that they're divided for different reasons. But you still have the same sort of split that you would have seen, you know, in the 19th century.
Yes, a true change, but continuity.
Yes.
So in your final chapter, you mentioned that Alabama is a demographically changing state. It has seen large increases in Asian and in Latino populations. It has seen a small decrease in white in its white population, as well as a kind of consistent incline in its black population. It has over the past several decades seen migration towards the state from regions of the South, but also the North, not to the same, you know, massive extent as Georgia or Tennessee, right, or Texas, but nonetheless, considerably more than Louisiana and much more than Mississippi, as they say in Alabama. Thank God for Mississippi. how do these recent elections, what are these recent elections is what I'm trying to say, demonstrate the changing nature of Alabama electorate? What are ways in which these increase in population and new demographics have made noticeable shifts in Alabama elections, or have they not? And then finally, what are ways in which Republicans and Democrats can expand their seemingly solidified bases? You do indicate that there are basically ways in which Republicans can even win more in Alabama.
Yeah. So I think that the demographic changes and changes to the electorate have not quite been large enough to sort of change electoral outcomes yet, right? So, but they might, right? And that's kind of what we're, so, you know, and Alabama, like, as you know, does not have sort of a metropolitan area in the same way that Georgia does, right? There's a Birmingham and Montgomery are not like Atlanta, right? And so, so you still don't have that, like you said, right? You don't have that level of change. But you do have movements in that direction. So, right, if we look down the road, if demographic changes along those, if there's more in migration, if there's, you know, an expansion of Latino voters, that might change things, right? Things have changed in other states. Georgia has become competitive. Texas, we can't decide if Texas has become competitive or not, but it's it's on a trajectory where it should be competitive, at least down the road, right? Alabama, I think, is not there yet, but I don't think that it will never get there, right? It could become a more competitive state just because, you know, of these kinds of changes that we're seeing across the region, that we're seeing in other states. And again, there could be other sort of upheavals that change things, right? We really didn't see this last change coming very far ahead of time, right? We could have, but we really didn't. Yeah, and so what can, you know, both parties, especially Republicans, so what I noticed is that, you know, if you think of, and there's a political science theory that says you can be sort of a position taker or an appropriator, right? So you can be Richard Shelby, right, who is retiring, but his whole thing in the Senate was bringing a lot of as much money as possible to the state of Alabama. He was a conservative, but he wasn't really someone who would go on, you know, Tucker Carlson's show and make some, you know, grand pronouncements so the entire country would talk about him, right? That wasn't his style. You know, he used to be a Democrat, so he was kind of, you know, this is how you win in Alabama, and what I want to do is sort of bring money to the state, right? I'm on the relevant committees, and that's my goal. That seems to be more appealing to voters in, you know, the bluer parts of the state than your alternative, which are these sort of more firebrand, you know, senators that that Alabama. So, like Jeff Sessions, right? So Jeff Sessions did really well in the state, but he did much less, or he did even worse, let's say, than Shelby in the Black Belt, right? He so there is a group of voters in that region that doesn't necessarily vote for Republicans, but that might be convinced to vote for kind of like the North Alabama, you know, voters in the 50s. Maybe I don't vote for Democrats, but I could be convinced to vote for a certain kind of Democrat, right? If it's a progressive Democrat, if it's this sort of more populist Democrat, that's more appealing to me, right? And so now you could say there's a voter here that says, well, you know, if you're not trying to be some sort of firebrand, but you're trying to, you know, bring projects and bring money home to the state, that might be appealing to me, right? So there are these different approaches that you can take. Now that, you know, to kind of take it to the modern day, that's not how you win a Republican primary at the moment. So there's a little bit of a disconnect here, but that's something that I think would help you, you know, expand into those areas, not win them, right? But do better and sort of improve your margins in those areas. So, yeah, I don't think, I mean, you know, people, I think, kind of saw Doug Jones winning in 2017 and thought, well, maybe that means Alabama is competitive. You know, that's clearly not what it means, right? That was sort of a perfect storm for you know, good or bad, depending on what side you're on.
No, elaborate on me, Regina, that election, because I was going to have that as a penultimate question, because I think there are some listeners who will think, wait a minute, didn't a Democrat just win this big election in 17? Why isn't it competitive? Tell us just briefly the conditions of that election that make it anomalous and not a trend.
Yeah, so Alabama Republicans nominated Roy Moore, who had a very sort of colorful history already before he became the Senate nominee. So he was basically removed from the state Supreme Court twice for ethics violations. So, you know, that must be some sort of record. But he had all of that, and he was still nominated, for the Senate seat that was held by Jeff Sessions before, right? So there you can sign. And Jeff Sessions, the last time he ran unopposed. So, you know, this is kind of how much Democrats had sort of given up on this seat, right? But now you have Roy Moore, and, you know, so that's part of it. He also had, I think a month before the election, he had this sort of scandal. So it turned out he was banned from malls, and there were, you know, underage accusations from young to underage women of inappropriate behavior towards them. So there was a lot sort of going on with Roy Moore. So that was your especially sort of scandal plagued nominee. And you, on the other hand, you had Doug Jones, right? Who was, a lot of times, if you're a not dominant party, one of your problems is that you have a hard time attracting good candidates because they know they're not going to win, right? So it's kind of, why would you do this? Like, why would I run for Senate in a state where I'm never going to win? So the people who do run, you know, for these elections of the sort of hopeless candidates happen to oftentimes be kind of questionable characters, but not in this case, right? In this case, you have Doug Jones, who was a really strong candidate. He had sort of a long history in the state. He had a really long and strong connection to the African-American community, right? When he was, attorney general, he was sort of working for, prosecuting the KKK members who had committed that bombing in the 60s, right?
Yeah, 1963 Birmingham bombing.
Exactly.
I would recommend listeners to watch Spike Lee's documentary, Three Little Girls, which goes over that incident. Doug Jones and George Wallace are featured very frequently. It's a brilliant documentary.
And the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, if you go there, there are pictures of Doug Jones, right? So there is sort of this whole history that he has that goes back to that. That made him a really good candidate. It made him a strong sort of candidate that also was able to really motivate a black turnout, right? That's the other thing, right? You need to. And so this was kind of a perfect storm of, you know, of candidates that you had, and you still had a really, really close election, right? You still had sort of, Doug Jones barely winning, right? Even with all these conditions, even with, you know, Republicans being, they might not vote for Democrats, but they might stay home, right? And some of them, I think there's some data showing that that's what some of them did, right? And some of them were like, I'm just going to sit this one out. And it was still really close. So, you know, that kind of indicates that was just a really unusual situation rather than the beginnings of a trend, right? Unlike, you know, the last elections in Georgia. You know, that doesn't mean Democrats are always going to win in Georgia, but it does mean that it's become a competitive state, right? And the 2017 election, I don't think means the same thing for Alabama, which, you know, in part is because we don't have an Atlanta, right? We don't have that.
Yeah, that 2017 to 2020, as someone who lived in the South, gave me a lot of false hope. The Democrats won in Alabama, and then they won gubernatorial elections in Kentucky and Louisiana, and then there was the Georgia incident. And so the moment I started to step back, I thought, wait a minute, again, as we say, these are kind of anomalous situations. Trump was also a very unpopular president, and he wasn't drawing the same number of people as prior presidents. But nonetheless, Regina, this has been a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed speaking about the content of this, again, very well-researched, data-heavy book that elaborates so much on the change in Alabama's politics as well as its continuities. Before we sign off, can you tell me a little bit about your future research projects you have planned? I think you already indicated you want to speak about 100 plus years of gubernatorial elections.
Yes. So that project is still going. And originally my plan was to turn that into a book project. I don't know if it will be that or multiple smaller projects, right? Mm. That depends on, you know, the speed of the data collection and how much data there is. Because if, you know, if I can turn this one state into a book, I don't know if I can put 49 states into another book, or if that should be more than one. So that's one project that I'm working on. And then currently, I do have a couple. I have a project with a co-author on endorsements in the 2020 Democratic primary. That kind of are trying to figure out why people endorse, right? So a lot of time when we talk about endorsements, we talk about the people that are trying to get the endorsements. But this is sort of looking at endorsers, right? What drives you to endorse one in a primary, right? It makes a lot more sense in a general election, but why would you endorse in a primary? So that's kind of what we're trying to look at. And I have another article length project that is going to look at the midterm elections. So including this midterm election, we're trying to look at which districts swing and if there's a relationship to the previous presidential vote share. So, you know, we kind of suspect there should be, but we're trying to actually get the data on that. And I think the last project that I have also with a co-author is a book length project looking at the basically American political history through policy. So we're looking at important pieces of legislation. This is going back to the beginnings of the country and the way that they shaped the political discourse and the role that parties played in that. So sort of that interaction between policy and the party system. So yeah, that's where I'm going, hopefully.
All of those sound fascinating, especially the endorsement book with the primary. It still boggles my mind that Tulsi Gabbard endorsed Joe Biden in the election. So I'm hoping that at least something will be touching upon that one. But nonetheless, Regina, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was really nice.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you. You have been listening to New Books in American South, a channel of the New Books Network, discussing Regina L. Wagner's book, Electoral Patterns in Alabama, Local Change and Continuity Amid National Trends, published by Palgrave Macmillan, 2022. Thank you so much for listening.